I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Will Restaurants Survive edition. It's Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. On today's show, we will be joined by Toronto restaurant owner Jen Ag to talk about the fate of the food service industry in a global pandemic. And then we will be joined by Jody Rosen to talk about the really horrible and premature loss of the great songwriter Adam Schlesinger, who died last week of complications from COVID-19. And then finally, this week's comfort culture specimen comes to us by way of Julia. It's the 1992 caper film Sneakers. It starred Robert Redford and Sidney Poitier. Joining me, of course, is Julia Turner, who is the deputy managing editor of the LA Times, joining me from LA. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens, who's the film critic of Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Jen Ag is the legendary Toronto restaurant and bar owner behind the dearly departed Black Hoof, Rum Corner, Grey Gardens, more recently Bar Vendetta and Le Swan. She's also the author of the memoir, I Hear She's a Real Bitch. I should say I met Jen, first met her when I was doing a travel piece in Toronto. And before we sat down face to face, I knew right away that she makes beautiful environments in which to dine, talk, hang, and be. They balance formality and informality really exquisitely. And she knows how to build a restaurant either with money or without it, which lets you know that her design sense is impeccable. I do love her restaurants. I also love her. Jen, it is great to have you back on our show.
That was so nice. What a bunch of nice things. I miss you so much.
Yeah, I miss you too. The occasion is a rough one, of course. There have been pretty dire predictions about the fate of the restaurant business in the age of pandemic. I want to make absolutely clear that we're not talking about the gravest human toll here. There's no way to minimize it. There's going to be destroyed lives and careers by the millions, but the restaurant industry is suffering, and we thought it was important to talk about it a little bit. So why don't you just discuss what's going on with you and your establishments?
Yeah, I don't even know where to start. I mean, every day is just a new adventure in trying to slog through to cocktail hour, keeping all of the horrible thoughts in a tiny little box that I only open for a few minutes so that I don't lose my mind. But basically, we shut down everything before the government mandated us to, because it felt like really the only choice and the moral choice. And we felt really good about doing it, even though it was a very difficult thing to do, because at the time we didn't know whether or not, you know, the government was going to step up and help servers who, if they go on EI in Canada anyway, really don't get enough money. I'm sure it's true in the States too, but the government did actually step up and do that. I'm going to be speaking so tangentially, it's going to get so annoying. And so we shut everything down and then realized, oh my God, like what's going to happen to all of our people? Stressed about that for many days. We weren't even really thinking about the businesses at first. We were just thinking about the staff. And then as that got settled and we started to realize that this was going to be a long haul, which seemed obvious from the start. Like I think it would have been quite naive to be like, yeah, this is all going to be over by June. Like that, I'm thinking maybe October, maybe March of next year. So now the big panic for us is rent. And the government here is not stepping up and intervening and telling landlords that they have to. I would be happy with April free and 50% for the duration, even though that itself is going to be a hardship. They've made $40,000 that are loans available, but that's just more debt. I mean, it's all very complicated. There's a lot more information and it's a different country. But I know that restaurants in America are struggling even more because their staff is not protected by a healthcare system. So I can't even imagine what's happening there.
Right. And this just makes plain how much at the center of a highly complex, integrated, balletic network of transactions, suppliers, distributors, producers, you know, lies behind the plate that lands in front of you at a restaurant. And when the entire system collapses simultaneously, it's unclear how the economic hit is going to be distributed. Of course, if the Canadian government or, you know, God were to declare a rent holiday, it would alleviate your problem, but it would simply transfer it to, you know, up the pipeline or in other directions. It sort of feels as though we're going to need some gigantic holiday and
well,
then
it's a bank.
Gigantic
it's a bank
reboot.
Problem. Of course.
Yeah.
And that's where it needs to be. That's where it needs to start. And then the banks need to offer mortgage relief, and the mortgage relief allows landlords to offer rent relief. I mean, it's obvious, and I don't know why they're not doing it.
Right. And then I just, before I hand it over to my co-hosts, I mean, talk a little bit about, you know, restaurants occupy a very, very specific place in the psychology of the contemporary city. They're sort of where we stage our semi-public lives in cities. And as much as people I know are heartbroken by, the larger and more permanent damages that are being distributed unfairly throughout both the Canadian and the American economies, there's a really symbolic importance to all of these places that nourish, like they both nourish us in this primal way and gave us a sort of stage set in which to enact no small part of our lives. And you as an owner must know that restaurants play a role in the life of a city that's not really a small one. And what's it like just to have them all disappear?
Yeah, I've been talking a lot about that on my social media channels, about how we probably, even people that are in the industry, realize how important these cultural hubs are and the community that exists within them. But people outside the restaurant industry, I'm not sure they fully understand what their neighborhoods will look like when 50, 60% of the restaurants, and probably the smaller independent restaurants, the cool restaurants, aren't there. So I think that it's really important to remind people, and it's not just restaurants, of course, I also mean hair salons and that clothing store that you pop into every month and that record shop and all of the places that work together to create the fabric of a few blocks, you know? And I don't know if people really understand the devastation that's going to happen if small business isn't bailed out. And I don't know the stats in the States, but it's 70% of our workforce here is small business. That's a big number.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, it's a Jane Jacobs nightmare, but...
Jen, in thinking about this topic before talking to you, we read this long interview with David Chang, the famous restaurateur of Momofuku, et cetera, in the New York Times. And part of what he had to say had to do with delivery and how he has always seen the future of restaurants as moving toward delivery, but that he thought that would take a decade or more to happen. And instead, it seems to be happening overnight. And I'm wondering how you think about how delivery fits in as both a way temporarily to support restaurants and try to help them survive this crisis, and also as a way that restaurants could survive in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's not... I understand why people are doing it. I totally get it. It's not something we want to do because it's not what we do. It's not what our restaurants are. There's so much, and I talk a lot about this, about how the importance of vibe and how often people don't fully realize that they're not just going somewhere because they love the food, and that psychologically something is happening where they're being taken care of and the lighting is just right and the music has been chosen to make them feel good, and all of this stuff is happening around them that is a subtle cue to just relax and have a good time. And that to me is what makes a restaurant. And that is not what delivery is. So I admire when people can do delivery well. We talked a bit about pivoting to it. Honestly, I don't know how safe I feel it is. And my husband's in his mid 60s. And so I we're being extremely cautious. For all sorts of reasons, we don't want to do it. But I also think that that's not necessarily the future of restaurants. I really hate that idea. And I can't imagine what could replace a place where you can go and get fed and have a glass of wine or a non-alcoholic cocktail and sit down with your friends. I mean, that's something we've been doing for a long time in different ways. So I don't think I see that going away.
Right. And there's also logistical challenges too. I mean, my husband and I, as New York refugees here in California, had a very takeout lifestyle for a while, and our New Year's resolution was to cook at home, and we successfully did it for January, and then we were like, hey, we like that, let's do it for February, and now we may do it for the rest of our days and are a little bit sick of our own cooking. We feel desperate to support the restaurants that are a huge part of why we've landed where we've landed in L.A. We're in a particular walkable corner of L.A. rare and joyous that is centered around this little hub that has a restaurant and a coffee shop and an ice cream place and a bookstore and a this and a that. And, you know, just trying to figure out how, like, there's no point in living here without those businesses. That's like why we live here. And so we're trying to figure out how to help them. But it's complicated. Like, one of them has turned itself into a grocer, but we, you know, submitted an order form to get a bunch of food from them like 5 days ago and haven't heard back. And, you know, no knock on them. They're trying to figure it out. But it's not the same business. It's not actually what they were set up to do. And just the logistical complication of doing that, you know, is clearly profound. The other thing that I am curious about is sort of how, what kind of networks restaurateurs are using to lobby the governments. And I'm sure it's different in Canada than in the US. And there probably is a lot of lobbying already in place around minimum wages or food safety policies, or, you know, to what degree is there an existing apparatus of restaurateurs relating to the government? And to what degree are people having to scramble up kind of new relationships and new alliances?
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially for someone like me who's so hated. So I think a lot of things have sprouted. Like, there's one in Canada called Safe Hospitality, and that's brand new. There are organizations that exist, but they're not known for, I mean, they're more corporate. You know, they're not really known for uniting independent mm-hmm. restaurants. And that's what's so interesting about the restaurant industry, is that it's not really an industry. Everything is sort of independent within this umbrella. So there, as much as there's camaraderie, it's not, I don't think we're necessarily used to operating as one voice. So, but there definitely are mm-hmm. people that are doing that. And in the States too, I'm following, you know, Hillary at Eater does a lot of coverage about this kind of exact thing. It's really good.
Okay. Well, Jen, I know you and I know you well, and I know your place in the firmament up in Toronto and Canada quite well. I know what you mean by your very funny joke that you're hated, but I'm afraid our listeners might not. They might misconstrue it. You're not hated.
Well, I guess, I mean, because I come across so charming on the radio, they're not going to know what I'm talking about. I'm not hated. I am making a joke. I think I've been yelling about all sorts of stuff and injustices and bad shit and dirty shit and terrible men, hashtag not all men, in the restaurant industry for a long time. And finally, it started to feel like the world was catching up to me. And it was a really nice feeling. But at the same time, a lot of people in the industry probably didn't like that I was doing that kind of calling out, and particularly the kind of calling out which was like, why are you also not calling out people? So, you know, I think that sort of sits with people in a way that they don't forget, and it doesn't, I don't know. I mean, I don't care, but it's definitely a thing. And, yeah. And now with this, you know, I'm definitely one of the louder voices in Canada, and I have a social media following, and people are paying attention to me. Big time people in the government all started following me on Twitter when this started happening. So I know I have their attention. And even though I'm not necessarily scared that I'm going to lose everything, although sometimes I do, I feel that way, like that, like it's a possibility if the help doesn't come, like how much debt can we go into? And I'm in a privileged position. I have all sorts of willpower to get through this. And I'd be willing to go into more debt to get through this. So, but there's all sorts of other people who I don't think are in that position. And I'm doing this not just for me, but for them too. So I think I'm going to circle back, I promise. I think that at the end of the day, even people that might have mixed or less than mixed feelings about me probably somewhere appreciate that someone is doing the heavy lifting here.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, listen, like, this is, capitalism is nothing if not the maldistribution of pain and pleasure, right? And we're very lucky to be on the receiving end of a lot of its pleasure by going to, for example, your restaurants. I know you've been a very conscientious employer. I wonder if a massive reboot means there'll be some thinking about how pains and pleasures are distributed.
Oh, because you think people learn lessons from things.
I know. I'm sorry. Incorrigibly, I believe it. But
I just don't. I'm such a cynic about this. You know, I keep having these conversations with people like, well, obviously this will push America left. And honestly, I don't know that that's true, which is crazy. But do you think it's true?
I hope it's true, but I'd be foolish to think it was. But Dana, I knew you wanted to jump in on this.
In a way, yeah. I mean, in one of my sessions of staying up till four trying to solve the world's problems alone, which I'm sure we've all been going through, I came across a really great idea being floated on Twitter. And I'm not sure if it was from someone from the restaurant industry or an economist or what. But it is, does, again, seem like something that is very unlikely to happen, at least in the U.S. I don't know about Canada. But this person was saying that really there's a simple solution to this problem, which just has to do with the massive downward distribution of wealth via a wealth tax for a time, essentially to float the entire economy, especially, as you were saying, Jen, mortgage and rent, and just freeze it in place so that all of those things can continue to exist. So there's an economy at the other end. And what this person suggested essentially was that the government pay restaurants to produce food, to become essentially sort of, you know, food banks. Or food banks sounds like they're selling ingredients, as Julia was talking about. And that to me doesn't seem to make sense. It's not what the restaurant was built to do. And so they're becoming a bad store instead of something that they could do well. But if you turned restaurants at the government's expense into sort of food centers, you know, places that people could go and get pre-prepared meals for a reasonable price, it would save all of these things at once. It would feed human beings and keep them alive and keep them from having to go to grocery stores and be exposed to a deadly virus. It would keep restaurants alive so that when this is all over, we still have an economy, which, remember, an economy just means us, people exchanging goods and services and eating food that other people make, right? The economy is not separate from those experiences and actions. And it would keep our neighborhoods, as you say, Jen, alive so that when all this is over, we recognize where we live and we haven't just had the vultures of Starbucks and big box stores and, you know, huge chain restaurants come in and swoop into all of that real estate. Obviously, we don't have a leadership in America right now that cares whether that happens or not. And probably there are many people in leadership who would be very happy to see us all live in a vampiric world of box stores and chain restaurants. But it's not hard cognitively to figure out how to do this. It's just morally hard to get the people with all the money, which is our money in the first place, to give it back.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of plan that makes sense. And I don't understand why it's not happening, except of course I understand why it's not happening.
Jen Ag, I want to finish with two questions. The first is, it's 4 a.m. in the morning and you're solving the world's problems. Where does your mind go?
I just want the government to listen to me.
I wonder what that would be like.
I mean, that's really what I want. I want them to understand how many people are sitting out there desperate, losing sleep, biting their nails, tossing and turning, just waiting for an announcement that addresses this huge, huge thing. And it has not been addressed properly. So that's it.
Okay, and Jen, here's my second question. I'd love to end on this note if it's appropriate. It's 5 p.m. It's drink o'clock. And you're going to get through one more night of this. What are you mixing?
Burgundy, baby.
There you go. All right, Jen, I hope to see you soon. And I hope to see you on the far end of this in one of your beautiful restaurants.
Me too.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. This show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
All right. Well, Adam Schlesinger died last week at the age of 52 of complications related to COVID-19. Almost certainly his music touched your life somewhere. He was the co-founder of the cheeky power pop band Fountains of Wayne, but he was many things else as well. He was the quiet genius behind the indie darling band that I quite love called Ivy. Their album Apartment Life is a masterpiece. He wrote songs for everyone from Click 5 to The Colbert Show to Sesame Street. He wrote 150 songs for the TV show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, for which he was an executive producer. He won a Grammy. He won 3 Emmys. That's his resume. But Jody, he was more than a resume to you. You actually knew him. We're joined by Jody Rosen. Hey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I knew him a very little bit because we lived in the same neighborhood in far west Chelsea in Manhattan in the 90s. And honestly, I've met my fair share of celebrities in my life. Adam was not exactly a celebrity, which was part of what makes him so interesting. He's this guy who wrote all these incredible songs and people know his music, but he himself had a kind of a low profile in public. But anyway, I knew him from around the neighborhood. I interviewed him a couple of times over the years, and he's a guy I would, bump into quite a bit. We lived a few blocks away, and I kind of was in awe of this guy. Like he was, I think because he was roughly my age, a couple years older, he was a Jewish guy, vaguely a New Yorker. He was from Montclair, New Jersey, which is not incidental to the work he made. Maybe we'll get into that, but his songs were very New York songs. Anyway, he seemed like someone I could have been if I was like a million times more talented than I was. And I love songs. I love songwriters. And he was kind of like the best songwriter who I had ever met personally and, crossed paths with when he was pushing his stroller down the street or in the coffee shop. I identified very strongly with the songs he wrote, as you said, for Ivy, especially that band, that album Apartment Life was kind of like an anthemic album for me in my early 30s in New York. And of course, the Fountains of Wayne song, which was so witty and funny and tuneful and really amazing. This death is a real tragedy. He died way too young, but he left behind a body of work, which really stands up, I think, to some of the great songwriters, not just of his generation, but of earlier generations. He's sort of maybe a Randy Newman type, but maybe a less dyspeptic, ornery Randy Newman. He's maybe has something in common with a little bit of Paul Simon, but he also has something in common with Billy Joel and Cheap Trick. So he's really an interesting figure, and his songbook is just packed with what to me sound like immortal classics.
Right. Listen, before we go any further, why don't you pick out a favorite and let's play it?
Okay, well, maybe we'll start with some of the music he made for Fountains of Wayne. This is a band that Schlesinger co-founded in the mid 90s with a guy named Chris Collinwood, another singer songwriter. They were college classmates at Williams College. This was, as you said, a power pop band. The music was, it's kind of Beatles chords and Beach Boys harmonies and loud blaring guitars, really fun, catchy music. But the subject matter, particularly in the songs that that Schlesinger wrote, these were very sharply drawn songs that told stories about characters, some of which may have been Schlesinger himself, but a lot of were kind of types that he observed in and around the New York area. They had a distinctly kind of Generation X orientation. You kind of felt the downward mobility of people who came of age in the early 90s during the first Bush recession in the stories he told. And there's a really beautiful song, 2.5 minutes long, called Hey Julie, which is off the third Fountains of Wayne album, Welcome Interstate Managers. It's about a kind of guy who's trapped in a shitty office job. It's a love song about that guy's girlfriend or wife, but it's really paints a super vivid picture of what it's like to be an office drone. Really a great song. So maybe we can listen to Hey Julie.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie, look what they're doing to me. Trying to trip me up, trying to wear me down. Julie, I swear it's so hard to bear it, and I'd never make it through without you around. No, I'd never make it through without you around.
Yeah, it's funny you started with that one as a listening sample, Jody. That was the first song of theirs that came to mind when I heard that he had died. The news that he was sick and was in the hospital with COVID had been going around. And then there was this rumor that he was on a ventilator, which turned out not to be true, right? Or that he was in a coma and that turned out not to be true. And so there was this kind of resurgence of hope, like he's going to beat this. He's a healthy guy. He's not that old. And so hearing a couple days later that he had not made it was just like this slow motion tragedy to witness. And it was awful. And the first Fountains of Wayne song that came to my head was Hey Julie, which I agree is just this masterpiece. I mean, among other things, it's so short. I just love a song that gets so much done in such a short period of time. It's less than 3 minutes long. I think it's like 2.5 minutes. And as you say, it's this beautiful love song, and it's really catchy, but it's also this just little thumbnail sketch of this life of being a wage slave, right? An office drone. It reminds me a little bit of the XTC song Earn Enough for Us, which is the same kind of idea. You know, the domestic space is this one place of happiness, you know, and the outside in the workspace, everything is kind of alienation and bleakness. And it's a lot to pack into a 2.5 minute power pop song, but that song just does it so wonderfully. And so that was the song I ran and posted to Twitter as a tribute to Adam Schlesinger. But I also wanted to just note, Jody, and I don't want to get sappy talking about this, but part of the reason I'm a Fountains of Wayne fan and that this affected me so strongly is you, because we saw the movie Music and Lyrics together, which is, I believe, 2007 movie, right?
Yeah.
With Drew Barrymore and Hugh Grant. It's a romantic comedy. And it's a wonderful romantic comedy, and really essentially what makes it a wonderful romantic comedy is the songs. It's about these two songwriters, you know, a singer and a songwriter trying to come up with a song together and have meeting all these obstacles along the way and falling in love in the end. And so, as with That Thing You Do, which is the song that he was nominated for an Oscar for, right? Did he win it? I can't remember.
He did.
The soundtrack
no.
for That Thing You Do. As in That Thing You Do, the movie itself is about a pop song and about the success of a pop song as it's being crafted, or in the case of That Thing You Do, as it's becoming a hit. So those movies hinge completely on that pop song being memorable and beautiful and as wonderful as the characters in the movie need it to be to drive the plot, right? And if you think of all the movies about artists that aren't able to make art, fake art that's good enough that you would sort of believe that it would make that artist's career, it's a really rare gem-like thing to have movies about pop craft that have a very high level of pop craft. So I remember seeing that movie with you and taping a spoiler special for Slate on the movie, and as a result of our conversation about the songwriting in that movie, becoming a Fountains of Wayne fan. And the first album that I got and started listening to was Welcome Interstate Managers, the one you just mentioned that Hey Julie comes from. So thank you for giving me that.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great song to pick out. I love that song. To me, that is like a power ballad for the ages, you know? He had an insane facility with melodies. Okay. He could just like, you know, write hooks upon hooks, but he is also, there's a fair number of people who can do that, but aren't, you know, literateurs, but he really was. He's just got a great way with the English language and with, you know, vernacular speech. And like, that's an example of a song that's written in a really spare pop song kind of style. You know what I mean? It's like the words are perfect and the images are surprising and original. You know, his writing there is really kind of spare and restrained. He's sketching a scene, like the bare outlines of a scene very beautifully in the way that like a great pop song can, you know, evoke feelings with relatively sparse scenery and, you know, just a few images. And if you compare that to the songs he wrote for Fountains of Wayne, for example, those are very, you know, those canvases are filled in with all kinds of details. And the stories he tells in the voices of characters or narrating the stories of characters are quite sharply detailed, right? So you've got there's, you know, any of numbers of them that jump to mind, but like there's a great song called New Routine, which is a kind of an amazing song about travel and people wanting to change their lives, that does this insane like Finnegan's Wake circle around to the beginning after globetrotting. But like, you know, it starts with these two old men who he says look quite a bit like Carl Reiner, I think is the line. You know, two old Jewish men, like, in a diner eating bagels, kibitzing, and that's like...
Just rhyming Reiner and diner, yeah. I love it already.
You know, and that's really, that's honestly one of the most amazing lyrics in that song that I've ever heard. You got to check it out. But, like, there's another song called Yolanda Hayes, which is one of my favorites, and that's a song about a kind of imperious, like, you know, a grumpy... desk attendant at the DMV, and the narrator of the song is a guy who's waiting in line, and he kind of develops a crush on this DMV attendant, having not spoken a word to her, and there's a great kind of denouement to that song. He writes about, you know, songs about commuters. He writes, of course, his most famous song, or Fountains of Wayne biggest hit, is that song Stacy's Mom, which is about a kind of, like, you know, a horn dog teenager lusting after his friend's mother, kind of a one of their lesser songs to my ear, but a lot so much fun, like all their music. You know, another one that's like that's so funny and amazing and is a song called Richie and Ruben, which is about these kind of hipster entrepreneur guys who are always trying to start businesses and failing, like trying to start hipster businesses, like opening bars and boutiques and going belly up. And the narrator of the song is a guy who's clearly loaned them some money over the years and lost all his money. And that's like just another example of his great storytelling skills. Maybe we could listen to that one.
They opened a boutique, they called Debris, together with some kids.
Jody, I'll remember the exact moment that I became aware of Adam Schlesinger and Fountains of, became aware of him as a songwriter, and that I might care about Fountains of Wayne, who nothing I knew about them second or third hand attracted me to their music until we had this conversation. I'm sure you've forgotten it. It was you, me, and a very, very, very penetratingly smart older critic were talking about Fountains of Wayne, and I said, I just don't, you know, I can't interest myself in it. And this, I think you or this person turned to me and said, well, you know, okay, so Northern New Jersey, New Jersey, you think Springsteen. Okay, so what's Bruce Springsteen's music about? And I said, well, I think it's about being trapped in a stiflingly small community, but finding some transcendent way out of it via love or automobile. And even if you remain trapped, there's still a, you know, a ballet out in the alley. What is the line? There's a opera out on the turnpike, a ballet being fought out in the alley. And then this critic said, well, I just have a question for you. Is there actually an opera out on the turnpike? And I was like, no, of course not. He says, is there actually a ballet being fought out in the alley? I said, not even close. And he said, okay, so what is Northern New Jersey actually about? And I said, it's sitting in absolutely standstill traffic on I-95, you know, surrounded by belching smokestacks and a horrible sulfurous smell, and the feeling that all of humanity, you know, the entire thrust of human history has been, you know, aimed at making you feel utterly belittled in that moment. And he said, that's what Fountains of Wayne is a genius at poeticizing. And you know what? That really is true. There's pop music, or rock music, certainly up to that point, probably had, even because you compare it to, you know, not compare it, by way of contrast, you say grunge had taken this new way, supposedly new way, of taking loserdom and once again bombasting it up to grandiose proportions. And that's kind of what he refused to do. He found poetry in the places where one actually has to try to find poetry in modern American life.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with our mutual friend who said that. Should we just say who that is? Because I think it's revealing. So that's Adam Gopnik who said that. And it's interesting that you know, Adam Schlesinger reaches Adam Gopnik. It's not exactly where you would go first, but it speaks to, I think, like, you know, the fact, first of all, it speaks to the discerning intelligence of Adam Gopnik, but also the fact that, like, you know, these songs are really, they're just really great songs, and they cross lines of generations. You know, like, I know a lot of older people who like Adam Schlesinger's music. I know a lot of younger people who like Adam Schlesinger's music. In fact, Adam Gopnik and his then 13-year-old son and I went to a Fountains of Wayne concert some years ago. But since you mentioned Springsteen, I think that's like a salient path we can go down for a second here. You know, Adam Schlesinger, Fountains of Wayne, have a great car song, which is like stands in stark contrast to Springsteen's. Not that I don't love Springsteen or his car songs, but like his car song is this song called 92 Subaru. And instead of it being about, like, you know, those Hemi powered drones screamed down the boulevard, here's the opening couplet of the song, which is like, talk about sketching a world in the quick of two lines. It goes, I bought a car off a couple of ladies way upstate. Took off the Greenpeace sticker in the New Hampshire plates. Okay, so what do you got there? First of all, there's actually been scholarship showing that lesbians are owned Subarus in disproportionate numbers. In fact, Subaru marketed to they became aware that lesbians were buying their cars in greater numbers than other demographics, and they subtly marketed it to the lesbian community. So you have that, like, true fact of, you know, it's something that exists in a phenomenon that exists in the world that I'm positive has not previously been immortalized in song, right there in the opening line. Took off the Greenpeace sticker in the New Hampshire place. Well, there you go. I mean, we all know, we've all seen that 92 Subaru, right? So the dude who, like, you know, probably for $950 buys this jalopy, gets it in that way. Anyway, that's just, like, to me, that is another example of the kind of, you know, his skill as a social chronicler and how much of the real world he kind of shoehorned into these songs, which also are just super catchy. And you can sing along without even really noticing what the lyrics are if you care to.
I mean, I got to just really quickly, Dana, before we maybe turn to Crazy Ex-Girlfriend before we go, I have a lyric from another great car song he wrote called I-95.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
hip-hop stations are fading in and out. All I'm receiving now is a kick drum mixed with static. Constellations are blinking in the sky. The road is open wide. It feels so cinematic. And then it deflates till a van driven by an elder gentleman cuts right in front of me. From then on, that's all I'll see. The guy just was incredible. But I loved what I saw of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And it is a show I'm going to watch in its entirety in the next few years without fail. But I haven't done it yet. But Dana, I know you were quite into the music and quite taken with that show.
Yeah, I wish we had Julia for this segment right now. I mean, for many reasons. I know she has lots to say about this band, but she was also a I think, completist watcher of that show. Whereas I don't think I ever watched Crazy Ex-Girlfriend after we watched some to talk about it here, but I listen to the songs almost every week because of my daughter, a musical theater aficionado, who I'm sure has no idea who Adam Schlesinger is, but already knows a bunch of his songs by heart, because she would just find YouTube clips of the Crazy Ex-Girlfriend songs and we'd watch them together. They were inevitably hilarious and beautifully staged and weird. And they were, and this maybe, Jody, is something you can speak to even if you weren't a watcher of the show, they were a real demonstration of Schlesinger's talent as a pastiche artist, because he could do any form of music, and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was all about, you know, finding new forms to send up. The one that we often sing together is is this song about yoga from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and the idea is that you're doing a yoga class and that there's a competitive rival who's showing off how much better they are than you. And so every time my daughter and I sense that there's some sort of competitive yoga or any sort of competitive exercising going on, we'll sing this song that goes, look at me, I'm so good at yoga. It's like, sounds like a Bollywood song. It's so brilliant. I do stuff with my body that no human should be able to do, like putting my face behind my knees, turning my hand into a shoe as the morning sun kisses the lotus. I kiss my own hoo-ha. Can you do that? Greet each day, namaste. Screw you, you're fat. Look at me, look at me, I'm so good at yoga. Yeah, I mean, the fact is I have to catch up with the Crazy Ex-Girlfriend stuff. I kind of didn't tune into that stuff just because I don't
watch a lot of TV somehow, which is weird, given that we're in whatever stage we are of the golden age of TV. But I can speak to his range maybe in a different way, which is talking about Ivy. So Ivy was the band he actually formed first before Fountains of Wayne, in a little earlier in the 90s. And this was a trio that included Adam Schlesinger and his friends Andy Chase and a woman named Dominique Durand, who was the lead singer of the band. Dominique Durand was from Paris. Andy Chase and Dominique Durand got married after Adam and Andy put an ad in like The Voice or something saying we need a singer, and they got this chanteuse, and she became the sound, the voice of the band, singing these songs that were co-written mostly by Chase and Schlesinger, but the best ones to my mind were the Schlesinger ones, and they're instantly identifiable as Schlesinger ones. But again, it speaks to his range, because what Ivy was all about was this kind of, they were an urbane band. If Fountains of Wayne were like the sound of like the Bridge and Tunnel suburbs in New York City, Ivy was a cosmopolitan New York band singing songs, kind of moody, somewhat dark, very stark and short and sweet songs about life in New York for kind of 30-somethings. And the styles that that songs like utilize were, like bossa nova and kind of Euro pop and jazz ballads. And there was kind of like an Anglophile thing going on there. So, if you're into the Go-Betweens, for instance, I guess they're Australian, but anyway, you'll like Ivy. And those songs, again, the lyrics are much different than Fountains of Wayne, not full of tons of details, but just enough, like the telling details, and they hit you very hard emotionally. And there's this song called I've Got a Feeling, which is like, to me, that's my number one favorite Adam Schlesinger song of all time. It's just one of these like bone simple, perfect marriages of words and music. It's just like a perfect love song. It's not exactly a love song. It's a song of like longing about a young person who's wanting to meet their partner and fall in love. And this song super resonated for me at the time that I was living a couple blocks away from everybody in that band and seeing them all the time, because this was kind of my anthem, because I like was like sick of the dating scene and I wanted to like, meet a girl and fall in love. And anyway, this song still like hits me and gets me where it counts every time.
This person has left us way too soon and yet left a remarkable body of work. And from that, let's maybe each choose a song that we'd love our listeners to acquaint themselves with. Dana, why don't we start with you?
Okay, I could go down so many roads, but I guess I'll stick with the album that I know the best and the first album of theirs that I loved, again, because of you, Jody. Welcome Interstate Managers from 2003, I think the album was. And the song is about something I know nothing about, football, but I love it so much. It's called All Kinds of Time. And it was circulating a lot on the internet last week after the news of his death broke, because in a strange way, it's a sort of a prescient song. It's just a kind of frozen moment in time of a football player who's about to throw a pass. And the chorus goes, he's got all kinds of time. He's got all kinds of time. All kinds of time. He's got all kinds of time. You have to hear it because it's also incredibly catchy, as Fountains of Wayne songs tend to be. But it's really reflective and melancholic. And I really recommend the whole album, actually. But that song and Hey Julie, especially.
Great choice. That I actually, in the appreciation I wrote about Schlesinger after he died, I singled out that one. I think that's a, it's an understandably was circulating this time, because it's really about, it's like a metaphysical song, and there are like intimations of mortality amid like this song that's about football. And but one thing to note is that the title phrase, All Kinds of Time, Steve will know this. This is like a cliche that play-by-play announcers used for years and years to describe the moment when the quarterback drops back and he's like well protected by the lineman. So he has all kinds of time. He can survey the field and like, wait to deliver his pass. And like, There again, Schlesinger like put it in a song, and not only just put it in a song, but like made it about something so much bigger and grander than just a quarterback about to throw a pass. So awesome choice.
Right. And did that so successfully that not getting that reference at all, I still adore the song.
Right.
I think I would pick, I mean, I-95, I just think is a great song. I love Ivy. Ivy is, you know, it's such a different mode to have a French, you know, chanteuse vocalist a la Stereolab. You know, to be writing for that voice is just remarkable that he could do it. I love the song Never Do That Again. It's the one that three or four songs into the record really hooks me on the record. And then the rest of the way through, it's just a flawless pop album. So I'd pick those two, I guess.
That's awesome. Great choice again. I guess I'll go with like one of his super funny songs. I think it's from the album Traffic and Weather. And it's a song called Strapped for Cash, which is, it's like a little, like almost like a seedy Tarantino movie. It's about a guy who's trying to like dodge his creditors, as it were. But in this case, the suggestion is that there are loan sharks or whatever, but it's just, it's like great music, a perfect little short story, tons of jokes, a little wink at Billy Joel's moving out in the final verse. Lots of Schlesinger songs were full of, like, you know, references and allusions to other pop songs. So yeah, Strapped for Cash, check that one out.
Before we close, Steve, I just wanted to note that Julia couldn't join us for this segment. She had a scheduling conflict and was very sad to drop out, but she talks about one of her favorite Adam Schlesinger songs, which comes from a completely different register of songwriting in Endorsements. So if you want to hear Julia on Adam, stick around for that.
All right. Well, Jody, as always, it's great to have you back on the show. I'm really sorry for your loss and our collective loss, but it was lovely to remember this person and this songwriter. I should say, Jody, that you're a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
All right, well, let's dig right in. Sneakers, as I said, it's a 1992 comedy caper flick. It starred Robert Redford as Martin Bishop, if that is your real name. He's the leader of a crafty band of misfits, security specialists. They're penetration specialists, I should say, whose job it is to try to break into your house, bank, museum, whatever, to evaluate just how good your security really is. It's a fun and sinuous screenplay featuring a black box code-breaking device, a murdered mathematician, and Martin's past, both romantic and otherwise. It's an insane cast, it has to be said. Whatever else is true about this film, you've got Redford and Poitier, these lions of old Hollywood, joined by Dan Aykroyd, David Stratham, River Phoenix, and Ben Kingsley, and Mary McDonnell. It's a fun one. Let's listen to a clip.
Oh my God.
How is this possible?
Cryptography systems are based on mathematical problems so complex they cannot be solved without a key.
Janik must have figured out a way to solve those problems without the key, and he hardwired it into that chip.
Turn it off.
Anybody want to crash a couple of passenger jets?
I said turn it off. Turn it off!
Hmm.
So it's a code breaker?
No. It's the code breaker. No more secrets.
All right, Julia. So on this movie's 20th anniversary, which if my math is correct, was around about 8 years ago, you and John Swansburg did something of a dialogue on Slate about your love for this movie, in which you wrote, "I don't think I've ever loved a movie as much as I loved Sneakers." Is that a consequence of the fact that you were, whatever, 6 or 8 years old when you saw it, or how did it hold up?
No, I was like a full-on 17 or something, I think. This is still my all-time go-to favorite movie, and I found rewatching it this weekend so pleasurable, even more pleasurable than I would have thought. I should also correct the record and say, not only did John Swansburg and I have a dialogue about Sneakers on the occasion of its 20th anniversary, we commissioned a like 12-part special issue marking its two-decade-dom. That took over the entire website for a couple days while we were off at a Slate retreat. So in addition to having a dialogue, we also had Lo and Lou try to recreate the famous bridge scene where they try to identify the bridge by the sound it would have made had you been trapped in a car's trunk while driving over it. A great Bay Area geography puzzle. We also got friend of the program, Nick Britell, creator of our theme song and the Succession theme song, to write about the hold that the amazing score had over him as a young wannabe composer in his own teens. So my love for this film is maximalist, and I have no objective ability to assess it as a cultural object because I can repeat every single line. So I will have to leave that task to you guys. Tell me you liked this movie or I'm quitting the show.
Dana, I'm going to lateral this one to you.
I feel like you're avoiding saying what you think about the movie, and it makes me afraid that you're going to say something terrible, which would be to me like tearing Julia's heart out of her body. I mean, I think that Julia, in part, my love for this movie comes from that special edition that Slate did of it and the ridiculous disproportion between you and Swanberg's love for this movie and its importance in American culture. And Julia, of all people, was always the editor at Slate who hated anniversary stories. Like, that's not enough of a peg. We can't talk about something just because it's 20 years old. But when it came to Sneakers, she made a very generous exception. I had already seen Sneakers at that point, but I rewatched it because of the passion incited by that issue of Slate, or ongoing, whatever it was, theme series of articles in Slate, and because of reader responses
vertical,
to it.
The Sneakers vertical.
And as you say, Julia, in part of your correspondence with John Swansburg, our former Slate colleague, about it, there's a kind of a, you know, talismanic quality to this movie where the people that love it really, really love it, and their eyes light up when it's mentioned and they quote from it, and it has that cult movie kind of quality. Although it was a success at the time, it was a box office success. It's not as if it was exhumed from, you know, years of unappreciation. It made plenty of money above its fairly modest budget, I think. But yeah, it does have that quality that it isn't like any other movie, right? I mean, even though it's so citational and referential, and it's full of, you know, references to former Redford movies and kind of old noir classics, and it's a heist movie and a spy movie and all of these things that are genre types, but it's completely its own thing. And I would posit that the true genre that Sneakers belongs to is the hangout movie, right? I mean, the way people always talk about Howard Hawks films as if, you know, they're supposedly or ostensibly about some sort of workspace, or, you know, they're war movies, or they take place in a newspaper office or whatever. But really, they're just about these extremely charming, charismatic movie stars sort of hanging out and bantering cleverly. And that's a huge part of what this movie is about. Although cleverly, I think, makes it sound as if the movie doesn't have heart or ideas. And I think it has lots of both.
I am not going to take a polo mallet to this movie. I'm not going to play that role, but also sincerely, because I did kind of love it. I fall somewhere in between Julia's reverential awe and the hilarious Vincent Canby pan that was included in our research document, which is itself such a relic. I mean, first of all, if you had asked me, I would have said Vincent Canby died in 1950. I mean, he's just such a voice from the past, the crotchety Olympian authoritarian critic who just dismisses it in three paragraphs, had no fun, without realizing the reason he had no fun at a particular movie is because he's no fun. And I feel like I play that role in contemporary American society, but I refuse to do it for this segment. I'll begin by saying what I loved sincerely, very sincerely about this movie. This is the movie the Mission Impossible movies think they are. I think it is a wonderful screenplay in some respects. It is meticulously, there is nothing slapdash about how the plot fits together. It is a rather considerably large and intricate jigsaw puzzle in which all the pieces integrate pretty seamlessly. And when they, I'll give you just a tiny example that gives nothing away. At a certain moment in the film, someone's wallet needs to sort of spill open, revealing a secret. So instead of just dropping the wallet on the floor clumsily or something, something that is integrated into the comic action of the film as driven by the preposterous character of one of the very minor characters comes perfectly into play. You're like, why is this even in the movie? And then all of a sudden you realize there it is. Very, very, very well done. And then the other thing I really loved about this movie is how both backward and forward looking it is at the same time, Julia. Because first of all, it's 1992. So I don't even know if in 1992 I was using email. If I was, it was in the most primitive interface possible. I don't think the World Wide Web or the internet, certainly. I mean, you're 4 years before Netscape went public, the kind of landmark moment where the internet goes big. So it's at the very, very beginning of the tech revolution and data revolution, about which it's sort of weirdly prescient, especially towards the end, about what the stakes are going to be in converting power into information and information into power. It's macabre and overblown in a wonderful way that befits a Hollywood movie, but in its own way, quite keen and quite right about what's about to happen. And then it's backward looking is that, listen, I may be slightly subjective here given when I was born and when I started really seeing movies, but to me, Redford is the last of the great old Hollywood style movie stars. Again, that may be an artifact of the when I was born, but to me, Redford really harkens back to the ability of Hollywood to produce really larger than life male sex symbols that united almost everyone in their affection for them. And Poitier is, of course, the great color barrier breaking Hollywood actor of the 50s and 60s. And, you know, Vincent Canby kind of rides them a little bit for being too old for the film. I think it's exactly the opposite. I feel like this is a moment when Hollywood is just about to go all in on the franchise model, where really the intellectual property is bigger than the star. The star is bigger than the intellectual property here in a way, and they're very, very, very charming. They're a pair of old sneakers. So that's what I love about the movie, and I will stop there.
I'm struck by one thing that Dana mentioned in her encomium, her forced encomium to this movie, because there's no option other than to like it, which is just to remark on the unusualness of it. Like, I think to me, that's part of what made me love it so much as a kid, and now it's just such a favorite sweater, I can't see it objectively. But I think the movie is overall a triumph of both pacing and tone. And to me, the tone part is the thing that is the most hard to put your finger on. But there's a wryness and a jokiness and a lightness to the community, to the hangout that you're referencing. But it's not like a Joss Whedon sardonic eye rolling. It's very sweet, right? They're sort of wry and light and amused, but they're not cutting and sardonic and eye rolling. And that it's just a very unusual tone. Like, I'm trying to think of anything else that sort of has that kind of quality of bemusement to it, while also reckoning with, kind of interesting themes. And I think to the movie is prescient. Like, the Bay Area intersection of radical utopian politics and radical utopian kind of technological dreams, and how they've been both aligned and at odds at various points in the last, 50, 60 years it's taking that as a really interesting, precise, specific, well-drawn setting, and then putting basically kind of just a ridiculous caper plot in the middle of it. But it's just such a nicely crafted, nicely paced plot with this unusual tone. I mean, am I wrong? Is this tone a dime a dozen?
Yeah, I had tone in my notes while watching it, and the tone also strikes some strange balance between irreverence and yet not cynicism, right? I mean, this maybe has to do with what you were talking about the counterculture ideals that are presented at the beginning. And the movie begins with this flashback of the Robert Redford character and the Ben Kingsley character, who I hope we'll talk about more specifically, when they're these youthful idealists played by younger actors who really don't resemble the older versions at all. And this dialectic that's set up between them at the beginning is kind of playful, and yet at the same time, what they're messing with, they're kind of trying to hack into various systems to make it look as if, for example, Richard Nixon donated money to the Black Panthers and all these kind of prankish things, but they're messing with scary stuff. And the movie sort of gets into that as it goes along. And by the end, those two characters, now played by Robert Redford and Ben Kingsley, represent those two different forces that you're talking about. But when we're back with the sneakers themselves, with this gang of ragtag sort of spies for hire, you know, who include the rest of the gang, River Phoenix, Dan Aykroyd, Sidney Poitier, David Strathairn, God Among Men, etc., when we're with them, that spirit of optimism and irreverence kind of rules together. They're kind of the permanent counterculture. And that's just this kind of beautiful spot to mark out in 1992. You know, Steve, it makes me think of what you were saying about Redford being the last of the movie stars. I feel like there's also a last little scrap of sort of 1960s idealism that hasn't gone sour within that little unit of the sneakers themselves.
Right. While being very wise about how, as Julia says, a certain kind of West Coast utopian tech aesthetic, as it picks up with a boomer, somewhat self-serving boomer sense of mission, you know, missionary zeal for changing and improving the world, it shows how that can sour into something, you know, really genuinely sinister, which brings up the Kingsley character. But one very quick comment, I mean, I would say tonally what I kept thinking was, I may be wrong about this, this is a potted theory that maybe deserves to go right out the window, but I often sense when I'm in the presence of something that was written by someone whose childhood took place substantially before television became the dominant medium, was written by someone who didn't grow up maybe as immersed in television. And then I feel like there are other points along the way. There's those people like me who grew up in the 70s, but you only had four channels, so it didn't permeate your life quite as much as it came to. Then there are people who grew up after cable TV, in which there's just the sense that all of the culture is sort of flooding you whenever you want. Like you can sort of flip on this mammoth 500 channel flood. And then there's, of course, the internet, which is whenever you want. You can choose anything you want. And I feel like a certain kind of shit-eating irony develops along with each one of those phases, that there was a kind of awe and credulity to people for whom the movies were, you know, because there was no television to compete with them, the moving image was dominantly the films. And there's just a reverential awe to writing movies that feature heroes of a certain kind. And as you go through it, irony just begins to take over and take over and take over. And with compensatory virtues, like incredibly funny, incredibly nimble, incredibly witty, but afraid, I think, of a degree of awe and reverence or even sincerity. And I thought that this movie was an interesting balance between the two. Dana, I want to bring it back around to something that you indicated, which I think is really true, is this Ben Kingsley character. You know, he's not that, he wouldn't be that out of place in a, you know, in Ex Machina, the Oscar Isaac character. I mean, his amazing piece of avant la lettre or whatever screenwriting. I mean, he really feels like a post Mark Zuckerberg, post social media, social network. You know, he's really a weirdly prophetic character, don't you think?
Yeah, there's a speech that Julia mentioned that, you know, she and all her fellow sneakerheads know by heart, which is kind of his big villain speech at the end, right? I mean, the moment when he finally...
It's about the information, Marty.
Right. It's delivered in this strange accent that he has, which is, you know, the British Ben Kingsley, I think, trying to sound like a Brooklyn Jew or something, but he ends up sort of sounding like a mid-Atlantic, you know, Hollywood classic dude. His pronunciation is hilarious anyway. But that big villain speech that he gives in the final confrontation is incredibly prescient. Other bits of the movie are somewhat dated in their kind of War Games-like vision of what this worldwide networked security apparatus would be like. But when it comes to Cosmo, who's supposed to be this visionary character, right? He's supposed to be somebody who's outside the system of the state, outside the intelligence system. He's, you know, sort of almost like a Robin Hood kind of figure, but also malevolent. The stuff that he says in that rooftop speech is the stuff that points most closely to what the internet actually did become. And in 1992, in a movie directed by and co-written by the guy who made Field of Dreams, right, which whatever you think of it is a very corny, classic, backward-looking Hollywood movie, it's surprisingly savvy about the future and about where we find ourselves now. And the melancholia of that, right? Because that character is morally frightening. And the people that he's leaving behind, the people that he's outsmarting, are the ones whose values we want to win.
And watching it now, Julia, we know that that person is actually the person who took over the fucking world that we live in.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe that's part of what makes the movie so pleasurable, is that it's got an unusual tone and an unusual, like, and I think the score, I actually would send people to Nick essay about the score, which is a really smart, I feel like I learned something about how to think about scores from the piece. But there's a way that the tone and the writing cause it to have a very unusual tone and feel. So you're like, what is this? I can't quite place this. I can't quite get it out of my head. It's a very enjoyable hang with a bunch of deftly drawn, but not overdrawn characters. And then it isn't stupid. It's not that smart, or it wears its smartness lightly. I think it just wears everything so lightly without being cynical or ironical about it. Like, they're like, oh yeah, we just happen to sort of figure out what the big obvious trends of the world are and the way that the world is going, and technology corporations that have access to our data will probably be the biggest villains of the future, but we're not going to like grab you by the lapels and make you think we're freaking geniuses for figuring that out. That's just like part of the plot of our caper movie. Like, and then that sort of the lightness with which it wears its correctness are part of what makes it such a beautiful little souffle of a movie.
I think that's true. It assumes an intelligence and a deftness, an intellectual deftness on the part, deftness, not deafness, on the part of its audience. And so it makes us feel that we're caught up in the caper too. And I do feel like movies nowadays, movies these days that try to take some sort of spy caper and turn it into a smart allegory about something else tend to not wear that intelligence very lightly and tend to be kind of rubbing it in your face how smart they are.
Yeah, it's true. The aesthetic now is to just overblow it by a factor of five. And that certainly is not what happened here.
Before we close, I mean, this movie made me think of so many things. And Julia, it was such a delight to just like watch it unroll before me again. When I put it on, I was really very cranky and I had a lot to do. And I thought, I've already seen this movie, but I got to refresh myself on the plot, whatever. And next thing I knew, I was just giggling and cheering along. And I just had to note one moment that in a strange, you know, absolutely impossible way, almost seemed to be prescient of our own social distancing moment right now, which is when everybody, all the sneakers, have to go hide out in Mary McDonald's apartment, the character played by Mary McDonald, who's Robert Redford's ex-girlfriend, who's this amazing, I love her character. And you're right, Julia, that she gets some of the best deadpan lines in the movie. But one of the things about her is that she's this, you know, extremely organized, professional, kind of glamorous woman who lives alone in this beautiful San Francisco apartment. By the way, one of the great Bay Area movies, I think, of all time, Sneakers. And there's just this great moment that all these grubby ragtag hackers invade her apartment with all their stuff because, you know, they've been traced by the bad guys, and they have to hang out there and do all their hacking and their, you know, crazy, you know, call tracing and everything with their equipment in her pristine San Francisco apartment. And it just made me think of where we are all right now. I mean, I just feel like I'm living with Dan Aykroyd and River Phoenix and David Strathairn in my face all the time and just having to deal. And that's just like a fun moment of sort of domestic comedy that's inserted into the middle of the movie.
I love that. And I also love the notion that this is like one of the very few flaws in the intricate plot, but we're supposed to believe that the police are on to Martin Bishop being Martin Bryce, but they're not going to check his ex-girlfriend's house. Like, that's their master plan for where they're going to hide and evade detection. It's like, okay. I like the character of Janik, played by a young Donald Logue, who is the kind of radical mathematician who has invented the black box that is the MacGuffin of the film, and whose Czech girlfriend accidentally helps the team discover where the black box is because she
talks about having left a message on his service poutingly. And the team has already described that there is a answering machine on the desk. And the David Strathairn character Whistler hears that, why would there be an answering machine if you have a message service? So that whole little bit where we very economically meet Liz, hear this hilarious mathematical speech about a something or other of Gaussian proportions, and then find his love nest, and then the black box just in such rapid succession is wonderful.
All right. I'm going to give my love, I think, to the screenplay, which, despite its hokum, is, you know, think about it this way. You know, if you'd pitch this in 2020, you'd pitch it to Netflix and Amazon, and you'd hope, you know, Netflix really, and what you'd hope is for, you know, you could tell it in 4 hours, maybe six, but Amazon would want 8 or possibly 12. And so every bit of it would be blown and stretched out, accordioned from here to the moon and back in order to, you know, and this is just old fashioned 90 to 120 minute filmmaking. And so you have, Julia, you said the key word, you have to be economical. And it knew, I think, exactly where, I think this thing was in development for in excess of 10 years. And it was, I think it was, it ended up a lovingly crafted and poured over screenplay. In they sanded off the edges, they lopped off the stuff that you didn't need, they allowed Robert Redford to act with his eyes instead of writing, you know, 8 scenes of dialogue. That's a bit of a lost art now that we're in franchise movie making and Netflix premium TV land. So anyway, okay, well, the movie Sneakers, I saw it on Amazon Prime. It should be pretty easy to find, and I hopefully we've pointed you to it. It's nothing if not comforting, right?
Yeah, that sweater of a movie, as Julia described it, is kind of perfect. A lovely pilled sweater that you can't wait to get into after work.
It is a lovely pilled sweater. Mm-hmm. There you go, Sneakers. All right, moving on. All right, Jody, you're going to stick around and endorse, I take it?
Yes, I am.
All right, let's start with you. What do you have?
I'm going to do two because I don't get to endorse much these days, so why not? I'm going to go for it. First of all, since we're talking about untimely deaths, or maybe in this case, just deaths of great musical figures, be remiss if I didn't mention Bill Withers, another great songwriter, supremely great songwriter and of course, singer, the kind of soul, what can you call him, like genre straddling soul singer who had blues and folk and jazz and all kinds of funk up in his music. He's best known, of course, for some just like absolutely immortal songs that are in his songbook. Ain't No Sunshine, Use Me, Lean On Me, Grandma's Hands, Lovely Day. Yeah, Just the Two of Us. We could go on listing these. But just to say, like, he was another songwriter who was a great, great storyteller and a really like warm personality that came through in his music. I mean, a song like Grandma's Hands is like, that's an amazingly economical piece of storytelling. I mean, he really is. It's weird, but he's of a piece with Adam Schlesinger in that respect. But his best known songs come from his first three albums, Just As I Am, which is a 1971 album, Still Bill, 1972, and then this Live at Carnegie Hall album, which is one of the great live records. But I wanted to like just point listeners towards some of his lesser known records. Maybe you should check out the album Naked and Warm, which is kind of a weirder funk, kind of almost fusion jazz singer-songwritery record from the mid-70s a great record. There's also an album of his called Justments. And basically, Bill Withers' whole discography rewards deep listening. So do yourself a favor and check out Bill Withers, and yeah, rest in peace. And then just the quickest word, just because I feel like this is like public service. My favorite writer is P.G. Wodehouse, the great English comic novelist, like the greatest comic writer of all time, no doubt. In fact, like when I was first discovering him, I think I endorsed him on the GabFest like 10, 12 years ago when I was first discovering his books. And I was such a neophyte and such a fucking Philistine that I called him Wodehouse That's so that to my eternal shame, I think that's like preserved on wax somewhere in the hand. Like, I wish that I hope I would that the fucking Gabfest archives be obliterated, at least that one moment of that one episode. But I stand by Woodhouse. I've since read like maybe 80 of his novels. But the reason I'm endorsing him now is like in this insanely trying time of, you know, when we're all absolutely freaked out and petrified and enduring great hardship of varying degrees and feeling fearful, etc. Like, Woodhouse is my comfort food because his world is a world that, like, admits no dark shadows. It's just all, like, sunshine and hilarity and brilliance and genius. And the best way I know to experience his books, even more than reading them, is listening to the audiobook versions of them that are narrated by this guy named Jonathan Sissel, who's just an incredible master of audio narration. So go to Audible or whatever other service you use to get audiobooks and check out Jonathan Sissel's versions of, like, maybe some classics like Uncle Fred in the Springtime or The Code of the Woosters or Jeeves and the Feudal Spirit or Uncle Dynamite, whatever. You know, basically everything that Woodhouse wrote between, like, 1930 and 1960 is gold, and the rest of it is, like, very close. But that's those 30 years are the sweet spot period, so...
Getting a 30-year sweet spot in your writing career is a pretty good deal.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he wrote for many decades, and like what his bibliography is like 119 novels or something like that. And those are the only one. I think he also wrote some that were pseudonymous. So, yeah.
That's astonishing.
Oh, man, I love it. I love an audiobook recommendation that comes with the perfect reader as well. And I'm such a Woodhouse fan, although I haven't read him probably in like 25 years. So that's a great
one. Okay, Dana, is it okay if we break form here and I endorse next and you go last? Because mine, it turns out, flows pretty directly out of a lot of what Jody just said.
Yeah, go with the flow.
Okay, so first of all, for the last 12 years, not coincidentally, I've pronounced it Woodhouse.
Oh, yeah. That makes me feel better.
That makes me...
And don't you have a higher degree?
It does not make me feel better, but if it makes you feel better, it makes me feel... Actually, it's zero sum. It makes me feel worse. But nonetheless, you've pushed Woodhouse, whatever his name is, on me for that period of time. And I haven't resisted for any reason other than narrow bandwidth and, you know, solipsism, but I will now do it, but I need you to do something too.
Okay.
Now, I know this is a windy way to get there, but a number of years ago, Slate had the bright idea of why do we wait until someone dies in order to appreciate them? I mean, there's this, I think it's inevitable that there's a certain outpouring of almost, it's almost as if your unconscious opens up and you realize what someone really meant to you, what their work meant to you when they're gone. And that, I think, is inevitable. It's very hard to bypass that or short circuit it. But Slate tried, to their credit, to pick a few people for whom people feel enormous gratitude in order to really celebrate them while they were still alive. So in the spirit of both of those things, of both me agreeing finally to read Woodhouse and in the spirit of talking about someone while they're alive and with Adam Schlesinger's music in mind, I think the most underrated living songwriter is this guy, Marty Donald, who was the principal songwriter for the Australian band, the Lucksmiths. And here's what I'm going to do, okay? Because I think a lot of what we said about Adam can be said about Marty, who we were very lucky to meet and have dinner with when we were down in Melbourne. I'm going to put together, let's say, between 15 and 30, probably closer to 15 song playlist, post it publicly on Spotify. And Jody, there's a certain kind of songwriter that I know you really love. Economical, brill building, you know, chimey, rhymey, clever, melodic songwriter. And I think that he's that kind of a songwriter. I actually think you might care about this music. And I...
Oh, man.
He is just in my all-time underrated pantheon. I listened to the 10 to 20 of his best songs, and he wrote 100 great songs, but I mean that the 10 to 20 best ones I just think are so lovely, and they're clever. They're clever, clever, clever songwriting. And they were indie big down in Australia, and they were indie small in the United States, which I think frustrated them eventually, but they put together a pretty big discography. So I am going to make my endorsement fully public this week. I'd love it if our listeners checked it out, because this person deserves to be better known. And Jody, I'd love your imprimatur on this, but you should be frank. But does that sound like a deal?
No, that sounds like it's such a deal. I'd never heard of Marty Donald or the Lucksmiths, but I'm so psyched to check it out.
Okay, cool. And you just have to be honest. That's, I know you will be.
Are you kidding me? For sure.
Okay, good.
Steve, you're going to send me that playlist.
I'm going
to
make
right?
that playlist
you're
make public.
It available to us all.
I'm going
to
make that playlist.
Right.
Every person in the world can listen to it, including Harvey Weinstein. The whole, no one's interdicted. But Julia, what do you have?
I am heartbroken to have had to miss the Adam Schlesinger segment today for time reasons, because I'm an enormous fan of his work. And I think I particularly am a fan of his work for television. I loved Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. I think the songs on that show were just extraordinary pieces of musical theater captured for TV. The Let's Generalize About Men song is just a great send-up of exactly what I don't like about certain aspects of modern feminism while still being a feminist anthem. Great song. But my endorsement for the week is actually a repeat endorsement. I've definitely endorsed this before, but one of the many great things that Adam Schlesinger did in his career was work on the Colbert Christmas special with John Legend. And for that special, he co-wrote a number of really wonderful songs. And the best and funniest of them all is the song Nutmeg, which is like a send-up of a 70s-style sex anthem all about how John Legend wants to be the nutmeg in your eggnog, but all of that as a metaphor for wanting to sex you up. And it is definitely the funniest spice-oriented sex ode I've ever heard, but it's also just a great song. And like, we are incapable of cooking anything with nutmeg in it in my house without breaking into the hilarious lines about wanting to nog that egg and all the rest. So a very, very, very silly favorite from a really, really wonderful talent. But in addition to all the other great things which Jody and Dana and Steve have no doubt discussed, I send you to Nutmeg.
And now's the magic moment in our program in which I say Dana.
Okay. An endorsement for this week is tough because as Steve and I were discussing off mic earlier, neither of us felt any joy. So we had trouble digging up what sort of cultural artifact we could produce to bring other people joy. But I will say that, like Jody, I have not been watching much TV. I find that if I have any time or desire to escape into anything, I would rather have it be a movie than TV. And maybe that's just always been my sort of preference, more of a movie than TV person. But the one TV show that I watch every week with my man, and we are so happy that it's back, is Better Call Saul. I know you're a fan too, right, Steven?
That's another one with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend I'm going to have to catch up on. What I've seen, but what I've seen,
all right,
I love.
All right, get out of here. Get out of here. Better Call Saul is the best thing on TV. I'm so happy it's back. And so I'm not endorsing the show exactly because we've already talked many times here about how Julie and I are giant fans of Better Call Saul. But an episode of a podcast on The Ringer, a podcast I don't usually listen to called The Watch, which is just about TV. And the second half of the podcast The Watch last week, the first half is interesting too. It's a discussion of the coronavirus crisis and how that's affecting television production. Totally worth listening to. But if you skip to around the 40-minute point, there's an interview with Rhea Seehorn, who, if you watch Better Call Saul, you know plays Kim Wexler, probably the best character on television right now. And every time I watch that show every week, I wish that there was a spinoff just about Kim Wexler or some sort of 500-page fanfic tome about Kim Wexler that I could read. She's one of those characters who seems to just be the tip of the iceberg, and there's so much beneath it. She's a fantastic actress, Rhea Seehorn, who plays her. And so you can listen for 40 minutes to her talking about her character, the show, the Better Call Saul universe, what it's like to work on that show. And if you're somebody who, like me, loves behind the scenes, you know, I love a podcast like the one June Thomas used to do on The Americans that just talks to the creators and talks about how the show got put together, you know, musically in terms of editing and all of that. She really gets into that. She talks about acting process, you know, acting for TV, just fascinating interview with a really intelligent woman. So interview with Rhea Seehorn on the latest episode of The Watch, and that's on theringer.com.
Marvelous. All right. Well, thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
And thanks, Jody. That was great.
Thanks a million.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today. That's at our show page at slate.com/culturefest. And I'll say it every week because I really mean it. We got great email this week. Email us at culturefest@slate.com. We will get back to you. Nudge us if we don't. We have a Twitter feed. It's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Jessamyn Molly. Our production assistant is Rachel Allen. For Jody Rosen, Dana Stevens, Julia Turner, and Jen Ag, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. Please stay safe, and we will see you soon.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.